spring has not arrived, and yet last night on the stage of the Grand Hotel, beautiful flowers bloomed. Among flowers, beauty is often relative, but on the stage last night, beauty was absolute. Last night, the graceful flowers among with their queen mesmerized the audiences in the amphitheater, which was filled with a crowd thirsty for novel arts. Perhaps this venue never had witnessed such a large audience, one that for about 2 hours did not notice the heartbreaking of the material life and instead witnessed the soul-captivating performance. Madame Agabayov, Pari, the director of the play, has a lot of novelties of this sort. It appears that there's no one person of taste in Tehran that has not reveled in her magical voice. Last night, this queen of flowers among her magical angels, like a strong commander-in-chief and her army, stole hearts and revitalized souls with every tune and song. Those who were revived last night exceeded 700 people. End quote. This was an excerpt of a review of The Goddess of Flowers, Elahe Golha, an operetta directed and performed by Pari Agabayov and her troupe in 1926 at the Grand Hotel located at Tehran's Lalezar Street. The reviewer was the prominent literary and political figure Said Nafisi, and the piece was published in the Daily Iran. To complete Nafisi's review, I quote another critic who provides a more descriptive account of the technicality of her performance. Quote, Mrs. Agabayov's flawless voice and harmonious movements fascinated me. Her mastery in corporeal arts was manifested when the king of the humans asked the goddess to move, and moved, and she moved in full harmony with the meaning and color of the music. Agabayov is the premier vocalist of contemporary Iran, and we will not be able to applaud her enough for who she is. End quote. As evidence from these excerpts, Satnik Agabayov, known as Madame Pari, was the star of the modernist stage in early 20th century Iran. In the aftermath of the Constitutional Revolution, when the stage was found to be an effective medium for awakening political and national consciousness in its audiences, several prominent musical and theatrical figures turned to creating Persian operettas. This provided the ground for the multifaceted Armenian performer Pari to take lead in these productions and to embody and represent the new ideas and ideals of the nation on the public stage. Born to an Armenian-Iranian family, she received her opera and ballet training in Europe. Upon her return, she was recruited to enact a Sasanian prince in the first Persian operetta, Parishehr va Parizad. Written by a young playwright, Reza Kamal, the play was publicized as one that would inform the audience of the customs of Sasanian era. Based on literary imagination of the writer, who also borrowed from Ferdowsi's Book of the Kings, and with the early 20th century romanticized urge for ancient Iran, this highly popular operetta drew several hundred of enthusiastic audiences who interpreted the play as actual history. It was in this context that Agabayov, who was praised widely for her role as Paricheh, which literally means fairy face, was given the stage name Pari and began enacting the roles of angels and princesses in nationalist, romantic, and pseudo-historical plays for decades to come. As I've explored in my research, the figure of Pari, angel, fairy or sylph, goddess, and ancient Iranian princess became the recurring asexual archetypes that legitimize women's entrance to public stage. So unfortunately, I don't have any images better than this of Patty, but I luckily found a recording of her voice in this play. So let's listen to it. I think it's pretty impressive for 1920s.
Was this in Turkish?
No.
She has a kind of Turkish accent.
She has Turkish accent. Her name is Turkish. I don't know why.
Armenian?
You think that she was born in an Armenian family?
Yeah, she was Armenian.
But the name is, and the accent is Turkish.
Yeah, but the borders may not have been that clear. 1921,
yeah,
maybe
she's
mixed. Actually, the name is Persianized when you say Agabayev. It's first Russianized and then because it should be said Agabayev. And to be correct, even in Russian, then it's Agabayeva. But then I guess in Iran they just use for men and women.
I actually don't
Bayov
know if Agabayev
is for women. And it's bay, not by. But then, maybe in Farsi, that's the way they write it. But
the Farsi. Oh my God, I can't find this. Sorry.
Yeah, the accent was so Turkish, but I couldn't understand the rest of it.
It seems that her husband's.
Was
Aga Babian. And her net, the only thing we know about her is
Babian?
That Aga Babian or Aga Babayan or something like that. But there's so many
different. So that would
different
make it Armenian, Babayan.
Babayan is,
why when it looks like this here, does it look right there?
Yeah, I think there's like several versions
that
of
are
this
open. Maybe they're conflicting.
Pati pati shodan to the Armenian
language.
Okay.
Yeah, we're talking about the transition from
yeah,
old Caucasia to
yeah,
these little countries.
But I'm
like
surprised she passed away in 1980, and there are no more photos of her. I mean, 1980 is pretty.
Yeah.
No.
1980s?
Didn't you say?
Yeah.
1920.
No.
She passed away in 1980.
Oh yes.
You know,
sorry.
So
yeah. Oh.
So there should be photos. I mean,
no, it's not just her, but there's so many others who don't have any. But that's a different story, and I can talk about it at the end of the talk. How difficult it's to find visual traces of these performers, female performers especially. Not only was Agabayev's artistic skill set a novelty for that era, but the public appearance of female performers even on this modernist stage was rare and mostly limited to non-Muslims, symbolizing Mother Iran or all women of Iran. An ancient Iranian princess became a prevalent character type in nationalist plays and operettas of that era. Yet in this era, most female roles continued to be mostly performed by cross-dressed men, This was the case with another important contemporaneous historical operetta, The Resurrection of the Persian Kings in the Ruins of Madayen, written by the poet and journalist Mirzadeh Eshqi. The script revolves around the poet's own dream, which unfolds against the backdrop of Eyvan-e Madayen, or Tagh-e Kasra. And in the dream, he witnesses some of the major ancient Iranian kings, including Cyrus, Darius, Anushirvan, and Khosrow Parviz, along with Zoroaster, all of whom mourn for the condition of Iran in 1920s. A significant role belonged to a Sasanian princess enacted by a cross-dressed man who mourned especially for the condition of Iranian women. But by 1933, Madame Pari took over the role of the Sasani princess. It is significant to note that environment of theater, which sought a new social order, was not content with the ambiguous performance of sexuality by zampush or cross-dressing men. Writing in October 1914, author and theater critic Kham Malik Sasani affirmed this frustrations. Quote, "I have to note that until women act in theater, we won't achieve a satisfying result. We have to learn from Istanbul to utilize Armenian and Jewish women so that odd men would not perform the female delicate roles." Similar stances can be found in writings by other authors in that era, including Murtaza Mushfeq Kazemi. Khan Malik's description of Zampush as an odd man and the emergence of female actors replacing the odd Zampush in the early 20th century new theater in Iran may be analyzed in light of Afsane Najm Abadi's argument on the heteronormalization of the public space as a product of the process of achieving modernity in Iran. In her pioneering study, Najm Abadi asserts the irrelevance of the gender binary of men and women in pre-20th century Iranian context, wherein separate visible gender categories such as Amrad and Mohannas mingled in public spaces. She argues that through interaction between Iranian and Europeans, Iranian society became self-conscious about the presence of European spectators who misinterpreted some of their everyday public homosocial behaviors as markers of homosexuality and thus backwardness. This spectatorship resulted in the erasure of some of those effeminate masculinities, leading to the existing gender binary of man-woman that has been normalized in modern Iranian society. This heteronormalization is eminently evident on the modernist theatrical stage of Iran, from which the transvestite Zampush was eliminated because he embodied these previous effeminate behaviors and therefore didn't match the image of a modern individual and representative of contemporary society. Furthermore, the level to which Madame Pari was praised and the position of non-Muslim other female performers as the locus of the gaze of their predominantly Muslim audiences is comparable to Tavakkoli Targhi's description of the ways in which European Farangi women were seen by late 18 and early 19 Persian travelers to Europe. Describing the European other women as fairies, these travelers, unaccustomed to public display of female beauty, saw the unveiled body of European women as markers of developed countries. Viewed as cultured and educated, European women became the future ideal of Iranian women. Similarly, the stage performing body of these non-Muslim other women were the subject of their male audience's gaze. In a theatrical sphere in which ideas of modernity and nation were largely being experimented with, the non-Muslim female performers' bodies were seen as the future and the ego ideal for the Iranian woman. Although up to the 1930s and 40s, the majority of dances were performed by non-Muslim women, nationalist periodicals gradually adopted a favorable attitude toward dance, encouraging their female readers to dance in the confines of their homes. This attitude was in keeping with the nationalist concern about Iranian women's physical health, viewed as a prerequisite for a progressive nation. The central assertion was that only a healthy and educated mother could raise healthy and educated children. Promoting the importance of sport and physical education for a healthy nation, periodicals emphasized the effects of physical exercise on women's mental and physical health, regularly referring women's activities in the progressive countries, including Germany. Dance was viewed in this context as an especially suitable physical exercise for women, a prevalent practice in those progressive countries, and thus became a signifier for the actual practice and embodiment of modernity. Particularly after the state-forced unveiling of women in 1936, Muslim actresses gradually joined the theatrical sphere, primarily as actors and not yet dancers. Concurrently, an independent dance scene emerged, prompted by new waves of immigrants from the Soviet countries who specialized in dance and opened a range of dance classes in Tehran, ranging from ballet, Caucasian to waltz, tango, and foxtrot. In fact, by 1940s, partner dancing became so popular that a manual entitled Manual of New Dances was translated by Iraj Akhgar from French. And you can see the cover of the book. With the World War II occupation of Iran in 1941 and the entrance of Allied soldiers, Tehran's partner dancing scene boomed, echoing the Euro-American dance craze in 1940s. World War II brought another dancing phenomenon to Iran, one whose influence still remains on Iranian dance to this day. This was the American Nila Cram Cook, the daughter of the theater director George Cram Cook and the novelist Susan Gaspel. Showing up in wartime in 1942, she temporarily was hired by the American embassy in Tehran as a cultural relations representative. She later joined the Department of Theater of Iranian Ministry as Ministry of Interior as director, meaning she was basically the head of censorship for theater and cinema. Meanwhile, she pursued both Iranian and American resources, ranging from the embassy to Shah's mother, in order to create an Iranian national opera. Cook then pushed for an American-based stage project to counter the Soviet dominance in performing arts, which resulted in the opening of her company entitled Studio for Revival of Iranian Classic Arts. She sought not only to visualize ancient Iranian history on stage, but also used a range of ancient motifs to restore the real Iranian dance and bring back, quote unquote, its religious and national status. Recruiting a female young ballet trained women of mixed or non-Muslim background, as well as several men, Her work featured the early 20th century archetypes of angels and princesses and drew upon Persian literature, archaeological findings, and Zoroastrian texts. Inferring from the archival my archival research at the National Archives here in the US, I found that wartime atmosphere of the American legation was fertile ground for Cook's venture. Firstly, competing with England and the Soviet, the United States was pursuing an independent propaganda system that distanced them from the negative reputation of the British and Soviets in Iran. Secondly, they were aware that Iranian people are susceptible to flattery, especially in connection with Persians' contribution to the fields of art, poetry, and architecture. I find a direct link between this anecdote and the field trips of Arthur Pope to Iran in preparation of his famous Survey of Persian Art. Indeed, Pope's book was one of the sources that Nila Cook used for her artistic creations. Here, I turn to her piece Ardeşir Babakan, which bore many resemblances to earlier operettas. It employed the backdrop of a dream to bring the founder of Sasanian Empire into a conversation with Darius in the background of his tomb, but also had explicit details in program notes regarding the use of ancient motifs. For instance, excerpts from the translation of inscriptions from Persepolis were used for the dialogue between the two kings. Angels of earth, fire, water, and sun. Angels of earth, fire, water, sun, and the moon were featured as characters, and their costuming was based on Sasanian silver vessels housed in the museum, at the Museum of Ancient Iran. The program notes for Cook's company's performance highlight this particular status nationalist venture, but by quoting from the pre-Islamic king of Darius and Babakan in the captions to the image of the pose dancers. A Babakan quote on the cover reads, quote, "O angel of the earth, awaken our nation from this sleep," end quote. One may ask that if the Iranian playwrights had an emotional attachment to Iran's glorious past and used such nostalgia for the purpose of regaining the glory, what was the American Nila Cook's intention for traveling to Iran in 1942 to revive the ancient Iranian arts? My answer is that it was partly due to her parents' involvement in the American artistic movements in 1920s, which took the family to the Delphic festivals in Greece for the revival of pure ancient Greek traditions. Growing up in Greece, Nila not only witnessed major American modern dancers, including Isadora Duncan, in search of natural dances in the ruins of Athens, but was herself involved in these activities, and you can see some of the images here. As in case of many other many modernist artists of her era who turned eastward for the authentic, Iran and Persian language attracted her. Furthermore, like many Orientalists of wartime era, she worked with the government. At the same time, she added another public diplomacy agenda for her project by using it to quote unquote, break the barrier of dancing for women of good families, an idea that was even quoted in Richard Arndt's book on American cultural diplomacy in the 20th century as a project serving the diplomatic purpose of US. Beside restoring Iranian sense of pride in their own culture, according to her student Nestar Ramazani, Cook's other agenda was to break down the barrier between public dancing and women of good families to contribute to the process of modernization in Iran. And in pursuit of this goal, legitimizing dance through linking it with the glory of ancient Iran and traditional literature, one of the earlier performances of Cook's studio was at the reception of the public relations attaché for cultural leaders in October 1941 at the garden of the American Embassy. According to Young, about 300 intellectuals, educational, and cultural leaders, including those from University of Tehran and Ministry of Education, were invited, along with members of the royal family. The event, according to Young, who was the cultural attaché at the time, the event became the talk of the town for several weeks. Particularly because it was, quote unquote, the first time that reputable Iranian families had permitted their daughters to dance publicly. Nestar Ramazani's reflection on their performance further completes Young's description, quote, our show was an instant success, far from being labeled as dancing girls, we were hailed as heroines. By infusing ancient Zoroastrian rituals and legends with magic and vitality of movements, Miss Cook had tapped into the Persian's pride in their ancient rules and cultural heritage, end quote. Cook's overemphasis on her dancers' background as women of good families was to counter the prevalent stereotype of cafe dancers of the urban popular scene. Often self-trained, these performers had to dance to earn money to feed their family in Tehran's budding public entertainment scene. These dancers were perceived to perform for lower class men who watched them while drinking cheap vodka. Cabaret dancer not only entertained them with her seductive performance, but conceivably had to meet with them off stage for a drink or more intimate relations. Cook was not alone in fighting social prejudices against women dancers as the three disciplines of dance, music, and theater grew apart. Dance studios began operating in Tehran by emigrate teachers such as Madame Corneli, Sarkis Jambazian, and Madame Yelena, and parents increasingly took their children to learn ballet, as well as dances from various regions of the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe. Yet parents of their Muslim students did not permit their daughters performance at public recitals yet. Yet again, tapping into the already familiar hybrid of ballet, literature, miniatures, and folk dances, a solution was found became a solution for the status of dance, an attitude evident in the words of Sarkis Jambazian, famous dance figure of the time, who saw himself as the liberator of the quote-unquote national art form of dance, who wanted to save dance from its vulgar position through reviving ancient Iranian ancient national and folk dances by staging them on point shoes, thereby depicting them in a manner easily accessible to a wider international audience. Indeed, the Iranian press was keen on ballet as an art form supported in all developed countries. The late scholar Ehsan Yarshater, who was collaborating with Jan Bazian on creation of a Shahnameh-based ballet, then published an article advocating the need for an Iranian national ballet company while recommending Jan Bazian as the best candidate for running such institutions. In 1956, the Iranian National Ballet Company, known as the Iran Ballet Academy at the time, was established by two proteges of Nila Cook, Haida Akhundzadeh and Nejad Ahmadzadeh, as Iran's first major funded dance company. Supported by the Ministry of Culture and Arts, the company aimed not only to entertain the court and public, but also to present the national arts of Iran to visiting foreign dignitaries. Besides functioning as a ballet company, this institution was meant to stage quote-unquote ancient and folk dances and to visualize Iran's literature and history. These included works such as Gorda Farid, inspired by the Iranian, again by Shahnameh, Iranian miniatures, Roya the Dream, which was a fictional story set in the Safavid court, and finally their milestone balletic production of Bijan va Manije, based on a love story from Shahnameh. This was performed in 1975. In the meantime, the Iranian press also engaged in finding solutions for enriching and elevating national Iranian forms, art forms, recommending Persian poetry as the most important inspirational source for artistic productions, a persisting trope from 1920s. Another trend in the periodicals was to offer historical narratives for the dances of Iran based on archaeological and literary evidence. Dealing with a past as distant as two millennia ago, some of these romanticized accounts presume the existence of dignified and even balletic dances in ancient Iran when princesses and even kings practiced them. Some accounts portrayed idealized image of Iranian dancers of the past. An interesting example comes again from Khan Malik Sasani, who in Shahed Shiraz, a semi-fictional travelogue, portrayed the physical criteria of dancers in Safavid time. Quote, "The dancer must be beautiful, must be young, very beautiful and pleasant, with a fit and proper body, large eyes, and a face like a flower. She should delicately follow the rhythm of the music and feel it. She should dance like the reflection of the winter clouds on the waves of the sea. She must be confident." End of quote. In 1967, the Iranian National Folklore Organization, Sazman-e-Milli Folklore, a large state-funded company created that again aimed to safeguard the nation's treasures in ethnic dances, music, and ceremonies, and to perform national dances to showcase Iranian arts and culture nationally and internationally, and they indeed toured around the world. In 1970s, and they actually came to Los Angeles and performed. The company created and staged a wide range of national dances, including choreographic reconstruction of the Safavi dancers as the narrative based Haftpeker. You can see the image here, which portrayed the Sasanid king Bahram's love story, inspired by the verses of the 13th century poet Nezami Ganjavi. Other works they performed were balletic productions such as Simorgh, which featured an angel who fought the wicked Ahriman, and Iranian love legends including Candle and Butterfly and Rose and the Nightingale. So wanted you to watch a little bit of this.
Yeah, it's mirrored now.
Okay.
So. Oh, wait.
It's
حسینی تهرانی را عموماً در موسیقی ایران به نام یک نوازنده برجسته ساز تنبک می‌شناسند.
This is not from Haftpeker, is it?
It is.
It's
called Zarba Zangula. The piece was in.
Okay. And then I think.
Yeah, and I lost him.
This is another one.
I can't find the.
But I am wondering, because she mentioned that they performed in Los Angeles once, whether they might have performed. Do you know where they performed in Los Angeles?
I don't remember, but it was right before the revolution, and I know that the revolutionary students took the choreographer and director Robert Dovaran captive on stage, like as hostage. So it was a disaster, apparently.
Excuse me,
be in 1970.
Were they incarcerated, or what happened to them?
No, it's just like, I think it was more of a, you know, it was just more of a. This is another.
I'm just wondering whether they might have performed here in Morris Hall, because UCLA used to have a far stronger dance orientation than it does right now. Gloria Kaufman, who's now much more involved with USC,
I had her thing open in
that
Firefox,
building down
so
there
was that
built
still
for her, but she kind of severed her relationship with UCLA. But the dance department here used to be extremely active in getting mm-hmm. both our own dancers from the American East Coast, like contemporary dancers, but also world dance.
Could
and
I
I'm
think.
Wondering if by any coincidence they
Well, I know that it's an incident that's mentioned also in Robert DeWarren's memoir, so I have to go check. But I know that they also performed in the at the Kennedy Center, but
uh-huh.
that one went went well.
There was Anthony Shea in the 1980s here. You know.
Yeah,
Anthony Shea was teaching dancing, and
mm-hmm.
I think he still is.
Yeah,
he's
I
around.
Think so.
Well, back then he was very young.
Ah, okay.
And I don't think he had the company yet.
I see.
I think he also tried to work a little with Robert DeWarren, but they
didn't
get along. Didn't
work there.
Well, Robert DeWarren was coming from, you know, the Royal Ballet in England, so saw himself much more. So, how can I?
I think if you
maybe
would just,
yes, just go. Sorry about that. The company dancers, I mean the national folk dancers, they're trained in the 3-year program of the College of National and Folk Dancers, Honarestan Raqsay Milli Mamahalli, which was dependent on the folklore organization. The students of this college were recruited from various cities through an audition advertised in the press. So by 1970s, we see that Iranian families actually are sending their daughters to become professional dancers. With the revolution of 1979, most of these institutions were dismantled. Yet within a few years, a renamed and reformed style of movement-based performance known as Harakat Mozun or rhythmic movements brought dance back to public stage. While in its earlier decades, this genre served revolutionary committed theater, portraying religious and anti-imperialist or war-related themes, it gradually shifted to espouse themes and movements from Persian poetry, mysticism, and the Shahnameh. And both of these are examples of the one on the bottom. The national dance style of choreography continues to thrive to this day, referred to by various labels ranging from, missed an important sentence, so I go back. So going back to Harakat Mozun with genealogical connection to Raqs-e Milli, once again, asexualized angels became the common typecast for staging women. And you can see all these angels again in these performances. The national dance style of choreography continues to thrive to this day, referred by various labels ranging from classical Persian dance and Iranian ballet to contemporary and traditional dance. Similar notions of choreography are prevalent in the Iranian diasporic communities in which national heroes and characters such as Arash, Rostam, and Gordafarid embodied by diversely trained dancing bodies, occasionally stir a sense of national pride in the Iranian audiences. So in conclusion, to go back to this, for about a century, depicting dancing women as angels and princesses against the aura of ancient glory, Iranian glory, and Persian literature has been the legitimizing rhetoric for women's dance that otherwise considered to be exclusively a sexual display of the body, a process that began with the early 20th century nationalist operettas that featured non-Muslim women, bearers of the aesthetics of gender modernity, who replaced the ambiguous sexuality of cross-dressed men. Collaborating with many father figures of modern Iranian performance genres and enacting roles in early performances, these non-Muslim women performers visualized the future ideal of modern Iranian women on stage. Embodying novel skill sets, they contributed to the formation of a new set of gender of aesthetic and gender behavior by training generation of Iranian dancers. Additionally, they also paved the way for formation of the national dance genre, a hybrid of ballet and indigenous movements, motifs, and themes. This genre indeed was the meeting point of fantasies of a glorious past with ideals of the future. It was an invented genre that was constructed to meet the demand for a national high art form, which heavily borrowed from literary texts, historical imagination, folk culture, and ancient symbols, resonating with the expectations of modern Iran. This trend was persistent in the works of Armenian choreographers in Pahlavi era institutions, and on post-revolutionary stage. The stage national dancer is a multifaceted character who internalizes the advocated virtuous characteristics of the nationalist biopolitics and discourse. She's an invented ideal female subject who combines charm with chastity and behavior, and internalizes ballet while claiming authenticity with her Iranian movements, themes, clothing, and music. Her healthy and athletic body is well versed in the physical training of both vernacular Iranian dance and ballet. Her corporeal modernity typecast various modes of the mythic ideal Iranian woman, such as the heroine in Gorda Farid, a Persian princess in Haft Beikar, a chaste beloved in Leili Majnun, and a pure angel in numerous productions throughout the 20th century. Her female sexuality is also regulated in her graceful feminine charm as she performed narratives of the nation for her audiences to witness and emulate. Now, to conclude, I wanted to show a little bit of angels on Iranian post-revolutionary stage. And these are angels on the Battle of Karbala. Yes. So they're carrying Ali Asghar to Imam Hussein, and that's Zainab. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.